Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, October 2nd, 2025, we talk about severe acute malnutrition with gastroenteritis in children, medical imaging and pediatric cancer risk, moderate hypertriglyceridemia, preventing RSV disease in healthy infants, and treating hypertension in rural South Africa. A review article on monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, a clinical problem solving on a shifting frame, and perspectives on insight into corporate governance, on pharmaceutical tariffs, and on OUD medications. A test for penicillin allergy? This new clinical decision's about a college student with strep throat who has an unconfirmed penicillin allergy offers a case vignette accompanied by two essays. One, supporting prescription of a non-penicillin antibiotic and referral to an allergist, and the other, supporting administration of penicillin under doctor supervision. We want to know what you decide. Cast your vote at nejm.org. Intravenous rehydration for severe acute malnutrition with gastroenteritis by Catherine Maitland from Imperial College London and co-authors. Severe acute malnutrition, the most extreme form of undernourishment, is a leading cause of hospital admissions among children in Africa. Many children with severe malnutrition have additional complications, such as severe dehydration due to diarrhea, which is associated with high in-hospital mortality, 27 to 41%. International recommendations advise against the use of intravenous rehydration therapy in children with severe acute malnutrition because of the concern about fluid overload. Although such guidance documents have been in place for more than two decades, no previous or subsequent evidence has supported these recommendations. Given the high mortality associated with the current recommendations, the adoption of intravenous rehydration strategies might improve outcomes. This trial, conducted in four countries in Africa, assessed whether intravenous rehydration, administered either rapidly or slowly, would result in lower mortality than the standard oral rehydration strategy among 272 hospitalized children with severe acute malnutrition with gastroenteritis. The mortality rate was lower than expected in both arms of the trial. Among these children, no evidence of a difference in mortality at 96 hours was noted between the oral and intravenous rehydration strategies. Editorialist Mark Peters from the Great Ormond Street Hospital Biomedical Research Center, London, writes that in 2024, a United Nations report estimated that 1 in 11 persons, up to 757 million worldwide, were facing hunger. Food insecurity and the risk of famine are exacerbated by conflict and climate change. Infants and children are frequently the most severely affected, as shocking images from sub-Saharan Africa and Gaza currently attest. Infants and children with severe acute malnutrition frequently have the acute medical complication of dehydration from gastroenteritis. The trial by Maitland and co-authors should be viewed as a trial that seriously challenges the perceived risks from intravenous rehydration. The upper boundary of the 95% confidence interval for the actual incidence of heart failure from these data with intravenous rehydration is 2.3%. We still need data from future large trials to evaluate whether these strategies are truly equivalent. But to the best of our current knowledge, intravenous alternatives to oral rehydration result in similar survival rates. Maitland and co-authors have provided important alternative treatment strategies for colleagues working in the most challenging circumstances. If additional studies confirm these data, hundreds of thousands of the most vulnerable people on our planet may benefit. Medical Imaging and Pediatric and Adolescent Hematologic Cancer Risk by Rebecca Smith Bindman from the University of California, San Francisco, and co-authors. Assessing the risk of radiation-induced hematologic cancer from medical imaging in children and adolescents might support informed decisions on the use of imaging. This retrospective cohort study quantified the association between cumulative radiation dose to active bone marrow from medical imaging and the risk of hematologic cancers among a cohort of over 3 million children in the United States and Ontario, Canada. Over a mean of 10.1 years per person, 2,961 hematologic cancers were diagnosed. The excess cumulative incidence of hematologic cancers by 21 years of age among children exposed to at least 30 milligrays, mean 57 milligrays, was 25.6 per 10,000. The investigators estimated that in the cohort, 10.1% of the hematologic cancers may have been attributable to radiation exposure from medical imaging, with higher risks from the higher dose medical imaging tests, such as CT. This study suggests an association between exposure to radiation from medical imaging and a small but significantly increased risk of hematologic cancer among children and adolescents. Lindsay Morton from the National Cancer Institute, Bethesda, Maryland, writes in an editorial that the report by Smith Bindman and co-authors expands the understanding of health risks associated with low-dose, less than 100 milligrays, radiation exposure, which can inform radiation protection standards and radiation-related carcinogenesis. The report is an important addition to the growing body of direct evidence regarding the small risks of cancer after low-dose radiation exposure. It also confirms the relatively short latency interval between exposure and cancer diagnosis of radiation-related hematologic cancers as compared with solid tumors. More broadly, imaging is important for patient care and can be life-saving, but is also associated with some measurable risk. To provide evidence needed for decisions regarding imaging, long-term strategic support of radiation-related research and education should remain a high priority. Ultimately, we need to ensure that all involved in medical imaging, from radiologic professionals and referring physicians to caregivers and patients, wisely interpret the results of studies such as that of Smith Bindman and co-authors to understand the balance of the very small risks and the notable benefits of necessary imaging examinations to provide optimal patient care. Targeting APOC3 with olezarsen in moderate hypertriglyceridemia by Brian Bergmark from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Highly effective therapies to reduce triglyceride levels are lacking. Olezarsen is an N-acetylgalactosamine-conjugated antisense oligonucleotide that targets the messenger RNA of apolipoprotein C3, which inhibits triglyceride clearance. In this Phase 3 trial, 1,349 patients with moderate hypertriglyceridemia and elevated cardiovascular risk, or with severe hypertriglyceridemia, were enrolled and then randomly assigned in a 1-to-3 ratio to a 50 milligram or 80 milligram cohort. The patients were then randomly assigned in a 3-to-1 ratio to receive monthly subcutaneous olezarsen or matching placebo within each cohort. Among these patients, treatment with olezarsen resulted in significantly greater reduction in triglyceride levels at 6 months than placebo. The incidence of serious adverse events appeared to be similar across the trial groups. Clesrovimab for prevention of RSV disease in healthy infants by Heather Zarr from the University of Cape Town, South Africa, and co-authors. Clesrovimab is a long-acting investigational monoclonal antibody against site 4 of the respiratory syncytial virus, RSV fusion protein. In this trial, 3,614 healthy preterm and full-term infants entering their first RSV season were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive one intramuscular 105 milligram dose of clesrovimab or placebo. In the first 150 days, a single dose of clesrovimab reduced the incidence of RSV-associated medically attended lower respiratory infection and RSV-associated hospitalization with a safety profile similar to that of placebo. Home-based care for hypertension in rural South Africa by Mark Seidner from the Africa Health Research Institute, Durban, South Africa, and co-authors. Poorly controlled hypertension is a common problem worldwide, particularly in low-resource settings. In this randomized controlled trial of a home-based model of hypertension care in South Africa, 774 adults with hypertension were assigned to receive home-based care, which consisted of patient monitoring of blood pressure, home visits from a community health worker for data collection and medication delivery, and remote nurse-led decision-making supported by a mobile application, or enhanced home-based care, which consisted of the same intervention but with blood pressure machines transmitting readings automatically, or standard care with clinic-based management. The home-based models of hypertension care led to a significantly lower mean systolic blood pressure at 6 months than standard clinic-based care.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple, to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, a review article by S. Vincent Raj Kumar and Saji Kumar from the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. Monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, MGUS, is a premalignant plasma cell disorder present in approximately 5% of the general population over the age of 50 years. MGUS is characterized by the presence of detectable monoclonal M proteins, which are identical copies of intact immunoglobulins, immunoglobulin light chains, or both, that are secreted by the clonal plasma cells. MGUS is asymptomatic, but can progress to cancer, specifically multiple myeloma, lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma, formerly called Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, or solitary plasmacytoma, at a rate of 1% per year. A variety of systemic disorders referred to collectively as monoclonal gammopathy of clinical significance, MGCS, can develop as a result of the secreted monoclonal immunoglobulin in persons with MGUS. The diagnosis of progression to cancer, or MGCS, usually requires histopathological confirmation to ensure that the clinical problem is attributable to the plasma cell disorder. No therapy is needed for MGUS, and the schedule for clinical follow-up is dictated by underlying risk stratification. A Shifting Frame, a Clinical Problem Solving by Alice Terrett from Flinders Medical Center, Bedford Park, South Adelaide, Australia, and co-authors. A 32-year-old woman was noted during early pregnancy to have some elevated liver enzyme levels on routine testing. She was asymptomatic, and her bilirubin, alkaline phosphatase, and gamma-glutamyl transferase levels were normal. Her past medical history included postpartum myocarditis after her first delivery. Over time, persistently high aminotransferase and creatine kinase levels raised suspicion for a muscle rather than liver disorder. She also had chronic neutropenia and later developed tender, hyperpigmented nodules on her shins, diagnosed as erythema induratum, with evidence of tuberculosis infection. Despite TB treatment, she continued to have mild proximal muscle weakness and elevated creatine kinase levels. Imaging showed intramuscular edema and fatty atrophy, and a muscle biopsy revealed scattered necrotic fibers but no inflammatory infiltrate. genetic testing ultimately identified a pathogenic dystrophin, DMD, gene deletion, consistent with her being a symptomatic carrier of Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, with skeletal muscle and cardiac involvement. The majority of female carriers of a DMD variant on one chromosome are asymptomatic. However, a small number have symptoms ranging from mild muscle weakness to more severe clinical features, including cardiomyopathy, as was the case with this patient. Duchenne's muscular dystrophy is a rare, progressive, eventually fatal muscular disorder manifested initially by frequent falls, waddling gait, and difficulty climbing stairs. Insight into corporate governance. What motivates hospitals and delivery systems? A perspective on the corporatization of U.S. healthcare by Stephen Lipstein from Denver, Colorado. Over the course of four decades, Mr. Lipstein held leadership positions at several prominent academic health systems. Yet, until he was asked to write this article, he notes that he had not heard the word corporatization used to describe what happens in his line of work. In part, the concern revolves around big corporations or private investors buying up and aggregating healthcare assets that previously were independently owned and operated. Critics of such large-scale combinations argue that when clinical assets are aggregated within contiguous geographic areas, there is market consolidation. And market consolidation leads to anti-competitive behaviors, resulting in higher prices without concomitant quality improvements, fewer small innovative providers left to disrupt the status quo, and depressed wages for healthcare workers. Delivery system leaders view asset aggregation in a different way, as a vehicle for efficient deployment of human, physical, and financial capital to achieve a healthcare mission. For example, expansion enables a healthcare system to diversify its payer mix and maintain a financially healthy balance of all insurance types. Too many publicly insured patients and not enough privately insured patients within a healthcare system is a recipe for financial instability. The risks of pharmaceutical tariffs for generic drug availability. A perspective by Thomas Huang from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, and co-authors. In April 2025, the Trump administration announced an investigation into the adverse effects of pharmaceutical imports on U.S. national security. Under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, the president has broad power to investigate and subsequently to adjust or restrict imports that threaten to impair national security. If finalized, the application of pharmaceutical tariffs under Section 232 would upend long-standing trade conventions that have protected medicine imports from tariffs. Increased costs for public health care payers and potentially reduce the availability of important generic medicines in the United States. For example, applying tariffs under Section 232 would provide generic drug manufacturers with an incentive to markedly reduce or even discontinue product sales, that is, for generic drugs that are disproportionately purchased by public payers, rather than absorbing the full cost of tariffs. Generic drugs, which account for roughly 90% of total filled prescriptions in the United States, generally have low profit margins and are mostly manufactured overseas. These authors believe that several changes to the administration's proposed policy on pharmaceutical tariffs are urgently needed to protect access to generic medicines. Goals for opioid use disorder medications: protection, remission, and recovery. A perspective by A. Thomas McClelland from the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and Nora Falkov from the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland. Medications such as methadone, naltrexone, and buprenorphine are the first-line treatment for opioid use disorder, OUD. Yet, most addiction treatment programs don't offer these medications, and most physicians don't prescribe them. The result is that only 20 to 25% of the patients who are at risk for overdose or other OUD-related harms receive medication for opioid use disorder. And even those patients are usually prescribed medication only for short-term detoxification. Along with stigma and lack of regulatory clarity, important barriers to broader prescribing include confusion and controversy about the appropriate clinical goals for OUD medications. A key question has been when, if ever, to taper and discontinue medication. At the systems level, the OUD cascade of care model is emerging as a standard tool for administrators of state and private healthcare organizations to monitor the management of OUD in their patient populations by tracking the movement of patients from identification and diagnosis to prescription of OUD medications, sustained reduction in symptoms with these medications, and ultimately referral to recovery-oriented services. These authors believe operationalizing the stages of this model for use in the care of individual patients could offer practical guidance for prescribers and treatment programs, reduce ideological controversies hampering progress in the field of addiction medicine, and increase practitioners' willingness to treat OUD. In our images in clinical medicine, a 52-year-old woman with hypertension presented with fatigue, vomiting, and confusion. Examination was notable for powdery crystalline deposits on the arms, legs, trunk, and scalp. Testing of a skin scraping of the powdery crystals was positive for urea, a diagnosis of advanced end-stage kidney disease with uremic frost was made. Another image shows herpes simplex virus esophagitis. A 29-year-old woman presented with a 2-day history of painful swallowing. 1 week earlier, she had had a fever and sore throat. Upper endoscopy revealed multiple volcano-like ulcers in the middle esophagus. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.